This morning, I'd love to pray, and then we're going to talk about slowing. Gracious God, you are good, and we bless you, God, for this time to gather as a community, your body, and to listen to what you have for us, us as individuals, and very much us as a community, who you are shaping us and calling us to be in this wider community and in the world. So may the words of my mouth and the posture, the meditation of my heart, God, now just bring honor and glory to you and you alone. And may we all have ears to hear and hearts to understand what you have for us. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen. Amen. So I find it fascinating that if we begin to talk about the word slow or slowing, that some people in the midst of that, their heartbeat actually picks up. Like, what are you talking about? And that makes me uncomfortable. And we get a little nervous. And I found it really interesting, fascinating, surprising that this week, as I was talking about with a number of people, just connecting with people in conversation about the idea of going slow or slowing down or slowing, that in conversation with people, that there was above a number of things when we talk about this stuff, but within the series, but typically when I talk with people, when I brought up this subject of slowing down, that the amount of pushback, it was either laughed off, yeah, right, slowing down kind of a thing. I got a bunch of that, and I got a bunch of, yeah, I don't think so. Like, how am I supposed to get everything done or get all the things in if I go slower? Yeah, thanks, Baldy, but I'm going to say no. It was amazing how many people said to me, no, it's not slowing down. If anything, I think we need to take the dial and turn it to 11, is maybe what they were saying. And it's interesting, but then I had to point out to them, as I will point out to you, actually the idea of speeding up or trying to get more done or more in, the French tried that. And the French, if we go back to the 18th century, right at the end of the 18th century, during the revolution in France, they actually took their calendar and they shifted the calendar. The French shifted their calendar, how they made it, so that there would now move to a 10-day work week. So the French said, we're going to actually do a 10-day work week because the goal here is to up production. We're going to see if we can take and increase production in our society. The experiment lasted a decade. They pushed through and they gave it 10 years in which the French did this. And the results were the economy crashed. The suicide rate in France skyrocketed and productivity went down. And they had to just refigure the whole thing out because they said this did not work at all. You can't move faster. We may think faster is better, more accomplishing, more winning, buying, seeing, and going. But I would argue that that which is deepest within each one of us would say, no, we need to go at a different pace. And I would say if you desire a life of love, joy, and peace, these are not compatible with hurry, with speed, with rushing, with going faster. So what I'd like to do is actually circle back to a conversation that I mentioned the first week of this series between a pastor named John Ortberg and a conversation he had with one of his mentors back in the 1900s. Back in the late 1990s, that's right, we're going back to the 1900s. In the late 1990s, John Ortberg was a pastor of one of the largest, most influential churches in the world, and he had a conversation with his mentor, Dallas Willard, who was a philosopher, writer, who taught philosophy at the University of Southern California and passed away 5 years ago, I believe. But this conversation was brilliant because John Ortberg asked Dallas Willard, here's the thing, I'm in this incredible influential church, but my concern is that the mega church machine is going to swallow me up. I feel like the pace I'm moving right now is not sustainable. So he asked him this question: what, Dallas, do I need to do to become the me I want to be? There was a long silence on the other end of the phone. As people who knew Dallas Willard said, anytime you're in conversation with him and you ask him a question, there's always a long pause. And then Dallas Willard said this: you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. John scribbles that down on a piece of paper, and then he said, okay, what else? Another long silence, and then Willard said this: there is nothing else. Hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Nowadays, we would say, mic drop. That's all that needs to be said there. Later on, John Ortberg reflected as he wrote his own book, and he said this in his book: hurry is not just a disordered schedule, hurry is a disordered heart. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to lean into that. The famous psychologist Carl Jung said this: hurry is not of the devil, hurry is the devil. Yeah, hurry, as I said, is incompatible with love, joy, and peace. If we want to be a people of love, joy, and peace, well, hurry just doesn't groove with that. Love, joy, and peace understands the difference between urgent and hurried. To have a sense of urgency is quite different than a hurried life. To choose love, joy, and peace is to deliberately choose a life of slowing, slowing down. Yet, here's the thing that's so fascinating. In our culture, the word slow is a pejorative, which is a fancy way of saying it has a negative connotation. It's a pejorative. Slow in our culture isn't good, because if we were to say someone isn't, if they have a low IQ, they're slow. Well, we're not going back to that restaurant because the service was slow. The movie, I didn't really care for the movie because it was slow. Merriam-Webster's definition of slow: mentally dull, stupid, naturally inert, or sluggish, lacking in readiness, promptness, or willingness. The message is very clear in our culture: slow is bad, fast is good. So says our culture. Yet our bodies, I would argue, and so do medical professionals, would say differently. Meyer Friedman, who is the cardiologist who rose to fame, theorizing that type A people who are chronically angry and in a hurry are more prone to heart attacks. We go, no, of course. He's also, Meyer Friedman, is the originator of the phrase hurry sickness, which, after noticing that most of his at-risk cardiovascular patients displayed a harrying pace of life. And he came up with this phrase and all of this study in the 1950s. So with that, what we're going to do is we're going to return to where we were last week in the scriptures, in the Gospel book of Mark, chapter 1, and we're going to revisit a story we talked about last week and then continue the story this week about a pace, a rhythm, a way of life that Jesus models, offers, shows us. So if you have a Bible or you're on your tablet, or if you just want to follow on the screen, we'll have all the words, but we're going to be in Mark chapter 1, verse 35 to 37 is where we will begin. And in this setting, in Mark chapter 1, what we have contextually is Jesus has just put in a very full day of, we'd say, ministry, of work. Jesus has worked really hard to teach this day, and then he did a bunch of healings, is what we would see in the scripture. And then in the midst of that, at the end of that, he chooses to step out of that moving and going and doing, and he steps out and he slips into the wilderness. is what we read in the scriptures, to reconnect and refuel from the source of life. Now, again, as we step into this, so you know, last week we pointed out the word wilderness in the Greek, in the original Greek that it was written, the word wilderness is the word eremos. Go ahead and say eremos. Now, it means wilderness, desert, deserted place, desolate place, solitary place, lonely place, quiet place. All of these you see in the scriptures, it's this word eremos. It's a very intentional place that you would go to quiet, to slow down, to pause, to listen, to rest, to recharge. And Jesus frequently goes to the eremos, to the desert, to the wilderness. And so we go now back to Mark. And our story goes like this. Very early in the morning, after all of this activity that Jesus has been doing, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to where? Yeah, the eremos, where he prayed. Simon and his companion, Simon Peter, that is, went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Listen, everyone is looking for you. You've just done amazing things. Jesus is teaching and healing and calling out evil spirits," is what we saw. Which I want to kind of pause there, and when we read and we go calling out evil spirits, we tend to think of, well, is this like this voodoo thing that Jesus pulls out the Freddy Krueger in everyone or something like that? No. Rather than just understanding what Jesus was doing when he calls like the evil spirits out, is Jesus connecting with people where they are and basically drawing out of them selfishness, greed, hate, a spirit of hate, of bitterness, a spirit of jealousy or resentment. And Jesus is like, yeah, that being that that's ruling your life, I need to draw that, pull that, cast that out of you. And then Jesus, after doing all of this work, stops, he rests, and he resets. And then verse 38 to 39, it says, Jesus replied to Simon Peter's thing, well, let us go somewhere else. Well, everyone's looking for you. And he's like, yeah, we're gonna go somewhere else then. To the nearby villages so I can preach there also. That's why I have come. So he traveled throughout the Galilee, circle that, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. Now, that word demons, so this is again touching on that because it's important. It's daimonias. Daimonias is this fantastic word for demons. Now, here's the thing. What it means is a messenger of deception. A messenger of deception. That's what he's calling out of people. The Jewish people actually understood this. What the Jewish people called a demon is they said this is the author of idolatry. It's a spirit that's just an author of idolatry. It's something within somebody that is deceiving you, calling you to put something else above God. And Jesus goes and says, we need to draw that, call that out of people. And so we're going to look now. Jesus is saying, okay, we got to move on to the next thing that he is doing though. And it just says that he goes around the Galilee region. So what I want to do is go to a map because that teaches us, just so we get an idea of where Jesus does 90%+ of his public ministry is in the Galilee region, which is a very small region in many ways, and the vast majority of the time he spends what we would say is the tri-cities or the triangle, religious triangle of Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, the lake here. But Magdala, where Mary Magdalene is from, there he spends a little bit of time there. Nazareth is where Jesus grew up. Cana is where he does his first miracle. But he hangs out in this region, not a big region. And just get at that, Jesus doesn't go very far, if you will, geographically. And how I want to compare this is we're going to look at another map that just shows kind of a larger, like this is a lot of the first century world, kind of the existing first century world. Now, real quick, just so you know, this little thing here, this is Israel. And here's the Lake of Galilee. So Jesus spends most of his time in this little itty bitty region. Jesus' entire ministry in this little itty bitty space, and this is kind of the known world. And if you see some of these lines, This is later, the Apostle Paul, some 20 plus years later, this is all of the places he began to go and start communities, build relationships with people, and in that, they started communities of belonging. They started what we would call churches all throughout the known world. But Jesus is here. Just that's it. And yet, then all of it later will go moving on. So when we hear things like when Jesus says to his followers, you will do greater things than these, and we go, he's Jesus, greater things than what he did, the you is plural. And wherever you are, if you live the way of Jesus wherever you are, well, if you all do that, you all can go farther. You all are in far more places than just he is. And so when he's getting at, like, if you live this out where you are, well, this will go a long ways. You'll do even greater things. Are you with me? Okay, good. My wife is. Fantastic. All those who follow embody this message. Well, it's going to go farther than. So we're going to keep going in the story and see where this takes us. In verse 40, a man with leprosy came to him now and begged him on his knees, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Moved with compassion, circle that word because it's one of my favorite in the Bible, Jesus reached out his hand, touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Now we'll just stop there just because I want to come back to that, because it says Jesus was moved with compassion. That word in the Greek is splagnizomai. Yes, splagnizomai, and the root of that is splagnon, which you're like, that's just a good time right there. But what it is, if you are someone who's like, you know what, my version that I love the most is the King James Version, then when you read moved with compassion, it says moved in his bowels. They translate it as bowels, splagnon, but what it is, it's the seat of our being. It's where they say you actually live from. We would say things like, I felt that in my guts, right? Oh, I heard the news and I had a pit in my stomach. It's like that place that moves us, that calls us to actually act. And Jesus, this guy saying, I need help, it actually ruptures that kind of seat of Jesus's being and saying, I have to do something about this. And that is stunning. And so Jesus says, yeah, I will. And I can. And he heals him. And Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. You have to go to the priest. And then when the priest says you've been cleaned, you offer sacrifices. Now you like get a certificate. I am clean. And you can take that out and actually be in the public then. Instead, what's he do? The guy, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. Whoops. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside where? In Eremos. Jesus can't, now he can't just go into the city. Now he can't even go into these small villages very publicly. He actually just needs to spend all of his time hanging out in Eremos. Yet what? I love this. The people still came to him from everywhere. They're going to him. Because this guy does what every one of us would do, right? I mean, you've been healed. You've been taken care of. You've experienced that. Well, you're not going to get, well, I'll just keep that to myself. Like, you're going to tell everyone what happened, sure, but that relegates Jesus to the Eremos. But the Eremos is very, very intentional space. So if you're going to go to the Eremos, you have very, very high reason to go there, which these people do. They're like, we're going to go to the Eremos because that's where Jesus is now. And we know this can change everything. So people find him. Now I want to look at Luke's version of the story, and then we're going to step into some practices together. This is Luke's version of the same story. He says, yet the news about him, Jesus, spread all the more because of what he did, so that the crowds of people came to hear him and be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus often withdrew to Eremos to pray. Like, he constantly is pulling himself out of this. So what I want to highlight, though, is Jesus does not go very far geographically. but his message does. Jesus doesn't go far in distance, but he goes very, very deep with impact. And I would argue that it has to do with the speed at which Jesus moves. Now, in his book, the late Japanese theologian Kasuke Koyama, well done there, wrote a book called The 3 Mile Per Hour God. 3 Mile An Hour God. And in it, he says this: God walks slowly because he is love. If he is not love, he would have gone much faster. Love has its speed. It is slow. Yet it is Lord over all other speeds, since it is the speed of love. Which would lead to my prayer for us, that we would be a community that is moving at the speed of love. Oh, that we would be a community that moves at the speed of love. There's your mantra. There's your screensaver. There's your next t-shirt. Right? I had to do it. I had to do it. Yeah. What does it mean to move at the speed of love? I want to be someone who moves at the speed of love. I want to be moving at the speed of love. Because everything Jesus did was intentional, was slow, if you will, because it was rooted in relationship. It moved at the speed of connecting with people. Our two church plants that are happening right now, it's a bit of a mantra for them. They actually say things, well, because people are like, well, what are you doing? How's it going? Have you launched? Are you going? Is the thing happening? And their response is, well, we're moving at the speed of relationship. Right. That we would be moving at the speed of love. The average human being walks 3 miles per hour. So did Jesus. So may we move at the speed of love. If you are new to the church, if you're new to the scriptures, the Bible, and you're not all that familiar with it, and you're like, yeah, I haven't read a whole lot, but you have attended a wedding or 10 in your life, you've probably heard 1 Corinthians chapter 13 read at a wedding ceremony, because it's often referred to as the chapter of love, and it's written by a guy named Paul, and he's writing, though, to a community in the city of Corinth. So it's actually not about marriage, if you will. It's about all relationship, specifically being in community together and what it means to live in community together. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, my heading even says love is indispensable, and it reads like this: and yet I will show you the most excellent way. Pause. Paul's been talking about a number of things, and he's going to say, now let me tell you, show you, not a way, the way, the most excellent way, the way love moves. And then he says this: if I speak in human or angelic languages, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Now here's the thing. In verse 4, he's going to begin to define love, and he says love is Paul is going to start to define love, the beginning of defining love. How does he begin by defining love? Love is slow. You want to start to just begin to define love? Well, it starts slowly. Patient. patient is how he begins to define it. Love has a speed, and it's slow. It's patient. It pauses. And then he goes on and says other things. But contrast that, love is patient, with hurry, with the speed of our culture. I'm trying to get out the door. I've got to get to my next meeting, and I got to go, and I'm jumbling. And my wife says to me, hey, real quick, before you go, can you quickly feed the dog? And I turn and go, like, what? As if she asked me to save the oceans, all of them, real quick before you go to your next meeting. Right? So apparently, evil to me sounds like a cat. Something there. Wow. Right? But if I'm in a hurry, I'm doing something and I'm going and some, hey, could you, what? Because when we're in a hurry, I would say hurry is incompatible with love, joy, and peace. Hurry is a recipe for strangled emotions. When we're in a hurry, all of a sudden we get bound up. We get uptight. We get cranky. I do, at least. Which is to then what? Act less than loving. So what I would love to do is I would love to just walk us through some practices, simple practices, on how to slow down. And I'll offer a little bit of commentary because, well, I have to. But these things, so you know, are practices that I've seen people I know love, who I love and admire much, leave these out in a number of ways. And so we'll just tackle some of them. And then we'll give some space and time for these to scroll on screen, and we're going to reflect, and you can write one or two down that strike you. But the first one is move slower. Yeah, move slower. The people I admire the most are not one step ahead of everyone. They're a beat slower. They don't react to life. They construct a deliberate life. They are thoughtful, wise, and move at the speed of love. Specifically, when I think of this, I think of my father-in-law. Because he's been doing a number of these practices for years. And if you met him, you go, why do you do these? You don't need to do them. You like are like so patient. Ding, ding, ding. Right? Right? Maybe because he's been like practicing them for a while. So anyways, move slower. Drive the speed limit. Come to a full stop at stop signs. This is fantastic. Seriously, try, come to a full stop at stop signs. I don't remember when it was, probably yesterday, and since we've been married for 16 years, my wife has always said, stop. You kind of got this rolling thing going. You know what I mean? That stop sign means you have to actually stop. Yeah, but if I come to the four-way stop and if I come to a complete stop, then Lucy over here is going to probably keep going. She's going to beat me. So have you ever seen, I'll come to a complete stop 10 feet from the stop sign because then I was first and I get to go. What are you, are we in that much of a, just pump the brake. In fact, step on the dadgone brakes, if you would. Okay, so don't text and drive. By the way, it's illegal. Could we just put it down? If me telling you I will be there in 5 minutes doesn't make me there in four. I'll be there in five. Whether or not, so, and yeah, show up, and this will help, or texting. Most of the time, hey, I'm running behind. Great, show up 10 minutes early, you don't have to worry about texting. Show up 10 minutes early and put the phone in the car. Whatever your appointment is, leave it behind. My phone isn't going into this appointment, this meeting with me. It's in my backpack. It's in the car. I'm not bringing it with because if I get in there and sit down and I have 10 minutes before they call my name or we're connecting, then what am I going to do? Candy Crush, I don't know, whatever the thing is. But I sure couldn't just sit here and actually maybe pause, reflect on, well, what has this day been about? What's going on? Did I get enough sleep? What in the world was with that dream last night? Like, just reflect, take it in. So next one, choose the farthest parking spot from the entrance. My father-in-law does these really, really well. 6 and 7, my father-in-law has been practicing. He liked when he told me about it. Yeah, I parked the farthest parking spot away. What? Now, here's the thing. So I started doing this. I love it when I would do this. Here's the thing that's fantastic. Have you ever seen when you pull in the parking lot and you start driving around and people are driving around because I'm going to get that spot in the front. Go park in the farthest parking lot, start walking, and then wave to them as they're still waiting to get in that spot there. And I'm going in the doors now, right? I'm heading in and they're still circling the wagons. I'm going to get that spot. Great. I already got my bread and milk. I'm heading home. Just take it easy. And then get in the stand in the longest checkout line. Some people just started sweating. She got angry and is leaving. Like, it's like, don't you listen, if you get in the longest line, you're going to hear fantastic conversations. You get to hear little Sally talk to her mom about the bubble gum, and that conversation is stunning. Just do that. Keep your phone off until you've spent some time in silence and or reading. What would it be if you woke up in the morning and the first thing you didn't do is grab your phone, but instead grab something to read, or just sat in the silence and just took in the day and took a big breath and said, "Oh, I bless you, God, because you pulled my eyelids open this morning. Well done, God. I just want to sit with that. I didn't wake up this morning. You woke me up. And I just need to take that in for a minute before I go to digital land." Maybe do that. So keep your phone off. Next one, put your phone to bed when you put your kids to bed, or if you don't have kids, or an hour before you go to bed. Very much been trying to practice this one, like, put my kids to bed. And I know you're thinking, no, but that's when I catch up. That's when I actually am going to, okay, so you get a little bit, but an hour before you go to bed, put that thing, just shut it off. Get those pixels out of your brain. They'll keep you up. And just shut it down. Which is to say, 2:10, put your TV to bed at a decent hour. Now, here's what's fascinating. They asked, the CEO of Netflix was recently asked, the CEO of Netflix was, who would you say, what other streaming services are your biggest competition? His response was, oh, our biggest competition is sleep. That's our biggest competition. My goal, his goal, our goal is to just keep you going. Watch the whole thing now, all of it, the whole season. Sleep? Who needs that? So what would it look like if we got, I've got to put it to bed. I've got to put the TV to bed so I can actually get to bed. Do you know, before Thomas Edison invented that thing called the light bulb, get this. Do you know what the average sleep for a human being was before the light bulb was invented? 11 hours. I kid you not, 11 hours was the average. That's what people did. When it got dark, you went to bed. When the sun came up, now you're awake. We invent the light bulb, and now I can keep going. I can keep humming. And our sleep goes, that's going down. Single task. I love it. Single task. We made up, multitask is a thing we made up. The brilliant Hebrew scripture Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann says this, multitasking is the drive to be more than we are, to control more than we do, to extend our power and our effectiveness. Such practice yields a divided self with full attention given to nothing. What would it look like to single task? Because the reality is that's all your brain can really do well. Anyways, I'm just going to do this one thing before me. This one person in front of me is who I will give my full attention to. I'm with you and you get my attention. What would that do to relationships? What would that do to a community that pays attention, that slows down? What would that do? Some practices, what I would love to just do now is, we'll have those just kind of keep circulating on screen, and Lauren will just give us a little background soundtrack as we pause, as we move a bit slower. And then I want to read a real short story after that as a way of a benediction. So these will go across the screen. You can figure out which one. Maybe just try one. That's just if you're thinking, I got to do all these, or I don't know. Is there one or two that said, I think that would be something for me. I should give it a shot. And the way we would say it is, give it a try. What's the best that could happen? What's the best that could happen, right? I think a community that is moving at the speed of love would be really quite brilliant. Gracious God, we bless you for pause, for rest, for reflection. We bless you, God, that you move slow. What an odd thing to say. God, you move slowly. And I bless you for that. I'm grateful because it's a reminder. It's a nudge of my heart. It's a whisper into my soul to slow down, to pay attention to a world that is happening right in front of us, all around us, just waiting for us to pay attention, to catch a glimpse, to smell the aroma, to see the gift that is right here and right now. Speak to our hearts as we sit and reflect. In the name of Christ. I take you to when Kara Mott and I sat down with Lisa for her interview, and she was interviewing for to be a part of our community in an employed way. And we talked about kind of how we gather on a Sunday morning and what it looks like. And I just remember as we were talking, Lisa has no idea what I'm going to say right now. We said, sometimes we'll do this. Sometimes we might do that. Sometimes you might just turn on the microphone and hand it around the room. We might do this. Sometimes we might not have music. Other times we might, whatever. And she's like, well, how do you have a time limit? Isn't there like a, don't you got to follow something? We get together once a week in this kind of way. We're in no hurry. We get to do this. We'll take our time. We'll do that. If you're like, well, that guy doesn't seem to think that we are hungry and want to get to lunch, he keeps talking. I'm not in any hurry. We want to take our time. And actually, Lisa's like, I'm in. Like, that's kind of, yeah, me too. I'd like to do that. And so I've been told we're coming up on 3 years old as a community next month. And I've been told 258 times, not that I'm counting, you cannot talk as long as you do. You cannot teach that long. You have to be under 30 minutes at a church plant. You need to be out of there in an hour as a community. Like, get this thing done. I just am just obstinate. I'm just a pain in the butt. Because love understands the difference between urgent and hurried. To have a sense of urgency for love to lead us as a community, well, it's quite different than living a hurried life. With that, a story. In January 2007, a man stood in an arcade just outside a metro station in Washington, D.C., and he started to play the violin. He played six very intricate pieces for 43 minutes. During that time, since it was rush hour, it was recorded that 1,097 people passed by him, most of them on their way to work. They videoed this. Throughout the video, people are hurrying along with zero notice of the musician. Not until 3 minutes in does one gentleman, without altering his pace, turn and look to take notice of the violinist. 30 seconds after that, the violinist received his first dollar tip. A woman threw money into his violin case, but she kept moving the entire time. In the 43 minutes the musician played, only 7 people stopped to listen, with all the rest hustling along in order to get to their destination. About 20 people gave money, but each of them continued to move at their normal pace. He collected, in 43 minutes, $32. When he finished playing each of the 6 pieces, there was mostly silence, and after the final piece was done, there was but one lone woman who gave attention to the musician. What she noticed, but everyone else had missed, was that the violinist was Joshua Bell, one of the greatest musicians in the world. He played 6 of the most intricate pieces ever written with a violin worth $3.5 million. 3 days before this, playing here, Joshua Bell sold out a theater in Boston where the seats averaged $100 a seat. May we be a community that slows down and is moving at the speed of love, so that you all and us together, may you slow down to be able to hear the music that is playing all around us all the time. And as you move slowly, may you know that the grace and peace of Christ goes with you all. Amen.